So this is the big day. I guess officially it's the 8th is the big day, Buddha's awakening. But nevertheless, congratulations everyone, if that's what you say on Rohatsu. Yesterday, Kate described the long journey that Siddhartha had undertaken before he sat under the Bodhi tree. And for the first bit under the Bodhi tree. And as Kate said, you know, it's much perhaps like our own lives, the journey that he undertook. Most of us have had fairly comfortable lives, at least physically. We grew up with enough food, warm clothing, education, medicine, etc. And just like Siddhartha, we were well entertained. He had musicians and storytellers and dancing girls. And we have our virtual storytellers, musicians and dancing girls. And then just as in the story of Siddhartha, something arises in our life, some tragedy, some loss, perhaps, some understanding of the nature of the world. Or maybe we just, it's just kind of a growing discontent that happens with our circumstances and become more and more aware that the world is not the way we want it to be, not the way we wish it to be. And we cannot make the world give us what we want. And we cannot make it take away what we don't want. And perhaps we come to see our life for really what it is. It is largely out of our control. Just like yaza, when you do yaza at night, you don't know what's going to arise in your mind. It's largely out of our control. So we begin the long journey, just like Siddhartha did, looking for answers to our questions. Maybe those questions we can't even really articulate, but we know we must seek and bring forth the courage and the fortitude to do so, to undertake this journey. And often, as was the case with Siddhartha, the first practices we take up maybe aren't so fruitful. You know, maybe you did drugs or something else, going to raves all the time, trying to find answers. But one of the things I most admire about the story of Siddhartha is that he had profound patience and great courage to keep on questioning and seeking. Even as Kate said yesterday, his teachers had kind of said, well, you got it, that's good. But he wasn't satisfied. He kept going, kept going. And the other thing I admire about him is he didn't go back to the palace and indulge in, you know, food, music, and dancing girls again. He didn't give in to that seduction of the kingship that was his, even after he had awakening. And even when he was caught in all those trials and tribulations and dead ends that he walked on. I think one of our challenges is not to give in to the seduction either, the seduction of the material world, to not believe the messages that we receive all the time from our advertisements and newspapers, radio, those advertisements that say our life's meaning and happiness is to be found in acquisitions, in iPhone 6 Plus, or something like that. So Kate talked about the visits of Mara, the various temptations and delusions that Siddhartha underwent, but he continued to sit and enter deeply into the truth of the reality of his life. He meditated for 7 days, And throughout the last and seventh night, according to the suttas, the early texts, it went like this. And I'm quoting now. I truly made effort and endeavor. My thought was firm and undistracted. My body was tranquil and passive, and my mind was concentrated. I was free of desires and unwholesome thoughts. In this manner, my mind became concentrated, purified, cleansed, without defilement, pliable, established, and unmovable. So at last, for Siddhartha, the conditions for seeing into the nature of his own reality, into the great reality, those conditions are now present. Siddhartha's heart and mind are settled, undisturbed by worry or judgment, and his mind is focused. He is completely present with his life. And then he directs his attention towards his own experience. And throughout, as they say, the first watch of the night, Siddhartha gained insight into the arising and passing away of his former lives and came to realize the consequences of speech, thoughts, actions that led him to this very present moment. Could say he kind of saw into the nature of karma. In the Zen tradition, you know, we don't talk really much about reincarnation or rebirth. But we can find much more discussion about this, of course, in the Tibetan lineages, which probably some of you are more familiar with than I am. But in the Zen tradition, we can understand that what we call this life is not an unbroken thread, but being reborn and dying almost every moment. Every moment. That what we conventionally call our life is really kind of almost like a flashing in and out of lives over and over again. So for example, the 2-year-old Michael, or the 12-year-old, or the 20-year-old, they're all gone in one sense. The Michael that was angry yesterday, that was happy last week, or frightened at a near car accident a month ago, that Michael is gone. There's only this Michael at this moment. All things being born and dying moment by moment. The Zen ancient teachers said, truly seeing this, is our freedom. Our freedom because there is nothing to hang on to. Truly seeing this teaching lets us open to love by letting everything be exactly what it is and then letting it go. During the second watch of the night, Siddhartha directed his mind to the lives of others and saw the arising and falling of all living beings according to the results of their karma. He saw the shape of all life on the unfolding of reality. And according to the text, it goes like this. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, I directed my mind to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. I saw beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, happy and unhappy, in their destinations. I understood how beings pass on according to their intentions. According to their intentions. All arises and passes away according to causes and conditions, one of which is karma. One of which is karma. The Buddha is clear in a number of texts that there are many forces that shape and affect us, and karma is but one. Karma, the Buddha said, arises from, in the Pali it's called satana, means volitions or our motivations. And as it says in the Dhammapada, that kind of famous collection of early Buddhist sayings, if one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, just as the cart wheel follows the hoof of the ox. Sound familiar? Heard that before? If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. In other words, one's life situation can be transformed by transforming our motivations. And our motivations will change our actions of here and now. This teaching of the Buddha is also a foundation for our freedom. While we cannot magically change our present, we can plant wholesome seeds for our future. The moment of freedom that we have is only right now, at this moment. Karma comes, but how do we respond? That will determine what comes down the pike later. So finally, during the third watch of the night, now we're getting to the good part, he saw the morning star rise. He saw it rise, and his mind became illuminated. Back to the sutta. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, I had direct knowledge, as it actually is, that this is suffering, that this is the origin of suffering, that this is the cessation of suffering, and that this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So here Siddhartha realized the dependent arising of all existence. He fully understood what we now call the Four Noble Truths, the nature of dukkha and dissatisfaction, the cause of its arising, and the cessation of its arising, the path that leads to that cessation. So all of this illuminated his mind. And then he continued on with these. When I realized this, my mind was freed from desire, my mind was freed from ignorance, and as I became free, I realized that I was free. This was the third wisdom attained at the end of the night. Ignorance was destroyed, knowledge arose, darkness was destroyed, light arose. Light. So on the morning of Rohatsu, kind of the last day, the morning, symbolized by the Buddha looking at the star of Venus, or the morning star. This is when we have to talk about what's impossible to talk about. The nature of awakening, of Siddhartha, and what that has to do with us, so many centuries later and half a world away from the India of his home. And as you're probably aware of, Zen teachers have a strong tradition of never talking about awakening. You ever notice that? And while it's true that much of the Zen literature involves situations of awakening, the literature refrains from describing it in almost any way. Like those myriad Zen koans, where almost all the end, you know, a lot of them end with a monk awakening. A finger is raised, a shout given, a nose pulled, some kind of enigmatic reply given to a Dharma question, suddenly, in that instant, the monk was enlightened. So here's a famous one. Once a monk made a request of Jiaozhou, one of our greatest Zen ancestors. "I have just entered the monastery," he said. "Please give me instructions." Jiaozhou said, "Have you had breakfast?" "Yes, I have," replied the monk. Then Jiaozhou said, "Wash your bowls." The monk had insight. If only it was that easy. And if only those ancient teachers would have left us a bit more to chew on. And yet, in all honesty, you know, when I reflect on my own years of practice, I'm really grateful now that none of my teachers filled my head with tales of enlightenment experiences or gave kind of pedantic explanations, you know, about what enlightenment or awakening may be. Because really, they wouldn't have been of any help at all. And yet, of course, it's also true that to have no vision, however hazy, is not much help either. Right? I think it's like this. In our modern world of striving, we can easily fall into the trap of adding awakening or enlightenment to our bucket list. Chogyam Trungpa coined a phrase for this, which you probably have all heard of, called spiritual materialism. Approaching our spiritual life in the same way that we'd approach buying a car or getting our teeth whitened. Right? We want to look for the best deal, get it over with as fast as we can, efficiently, and then move on to the next enticing thing. You may imagine, and certainly looking at all the literature that's around, you may imagine that there is such a thing as enlightenment or an awakening. But in the Buddhist tradition, awakening is not a thing. It's not a noun. It's more like a verb. Suzuki Roshi, I think, expressed it really well. Suzuki Roshi, the Zen teacher who brought this lineage from Japan to North America, he said this, "Strictly speaking, there are no enlightened people. There is only enlightened activity." I like that. There's only enlightened activity, not enlightened people. Dogen Zenji, the Japanese monk who brought this form of Buddhism from China to Japan way back in the 1200s, he wrote this, "Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who have great realization about delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization," anybody here? "are just sentient beings." In other words, deluded people have delusions about enlightenment, and Buddhas have great realizations about their delusions. Does that make sense? Kind of cool. I suppose we all have delusions about awakening. It is natural that we would have delusions about some wonderful realm of awakening that exists in some place at some time in the future. In our state of unhappiness, we feel there's something we need to get, something we need to transcend. We need to become somebody other than who we are. And those kind of feelings. And when you realize that you are thinking thoughts like this, though, please don't despair. That's exactly what you should be doing. For this realization of your deluded thinking is enlightened activity. You're realizing, oh, what am I thinking about? There's going to be paradise somewhere else. So you're on the right track. As soon as you realize you're thinking about those, you're on the right track. Because remember, Dogen wrote that Buddhas have great realization about delusion. We take up the practice of acknowledging the ways in which we think we are not at the place or time of awakening. And I can tell you last night during Yaza, there were many times where I thought, I'm not here. This is not awakening. Anyway, Dogen continues on. He writes, you know, a little bit more about this. He's trying to, you know, get us on the right path here. This is a different text called Only a Buddha and a Buddha. He wrote this. Buddha Dharma cannot be known by a person. Since olden times, no ordinary person has realized Buddha Dharma. Indicating, I think, that we cannot, in our kind of state that we're in, really know awakening. We cannot describe it with a set of adjectives or descriptive phrases like we would a new restaurant or a travel adventure we're coming back from. It's unknowable in that way because great awakening goes beyond. Dogen continues, when you realize the Buddha Dharma, you do not think, oh, this realization is just what I expected. Realization inevitably differs from your expectation. Realization is not like your conception of it. Accordingly, realization cannot take place as previously conceived. When you realize Buddha Dharma, you do not consider how realization came about. Reflect on this. What you think one way or another before realization is not a help for realization. You know what he's telling us? He said, let go, guys. Just let go. Do the practice. A little bit of trust. You're not going to think your way out of this. You're not going to think your way out of this. Realization does not depend on thoughts, but comes from far beyond them. So Dogen is cautioning us not to get entangled with our thoughts about awakening. Because such thoughts are, not because they're inherently bad, you know, it's not that you shouldn't have those, but it's just that they distract us from our practice. And he's also indicating, you know, you may not realize you're awakened. Like when you have these moments of awakening, when you have awakening activity, it may not, like, gel until afterwards. Oh, maybe that was a moment of awakened activity. Anyway, these thoughts are kind of distractions. I've noticed in myself at times longings to leave behind the various vicissitudes of my life, especially when nothing seems to be going right. You know, all the traditional religions offer the possibilities of like paradise, heaven, nirvana, Valhalla, oneness with the divine, where only the highest qualities of love, compassion, wisdom, purity, and joy exist. And frankly, these can be taken as kind of places of escape from the challenges of life. You know, I'm aiming, I want to get me out of here, I want to go over there. And I must confess, when I was a very young teenager, I used to fantasize that a flying saucer would come one day and take me away from this life of junior high school. So is awakening another escape? Suzuki Roshi, who I think had a really good sense of humor, once said, you may get enlightened and not like it. Now, did you ever think of that? So, you know, take a few moments right now and consider, you know, what you're seeking in your practice. What are you seeking in your practice? Do you seek a form of transcendence? Some way getting outside of, going beyond this world? Do you seek a kind of calm, abiding in deep awareness, free from the frustrations of this life? In other words, some state or place beyond the disarray of this daily life. Well, I have thoughts like this. But I think these views of awakening are awakening as some kind of state, right? Different from the state I'm in right now. Consider this. Perhaps awakening is a way of facing moment after moment your own life itself. Each moment freely meeting your life. Doing what's called for and fully receiving the result. Consider this. Perhaps awakening has always been here, intimate with us all along, just like the beating of our hearts or the in and out of our breath. Or consider this. Perhaps awakening flashes like lightning and shakes and thunders. Or perhaps it is like walking in a mist, unaware your clothes are getting wet. Dogen wrote, "Awakening is like the moon reflected on the water. The moon does not get wet, nor is the water broken. Although its light is wide and great, the moon is reflected even in a puddle an inch wide. The whole moon and the entire sky. Awakening does not divide you, just as the moon does not break the water. You cannot hinder awakening, just as a drop of water does not hinder the moon in the sky." We don't know what the Buddha experienced when he saw the morning star. Dogen and the other teachers tell us, whatever we imagine is not quite it. Whatever we imagine is not quite it. But they're also telling us in the same passages, the same texts, it's as close to you as your own skin. We think often that awakening is somewhere else. Uh, And of course, the Zen masters don't tell us or give us much help to figure all this out. It's our own journey, each one of us and together, that we undertake just as Siddhartha did. And all of our ancestors have done for 2,500 years. We need courage, patience, kindness. And we need humor. Good dose of humor. Who knows? When we get enlightened, you may not like it. The Buddha, after his awakening, continued to live and teach until he was an old man. And there are so many stories about that. But I hope the story that you've heard about the Buddha's awakening from Kate and a little bit from me will be of some aid in your own journey. To know that you are not alone. People have walked in this path before. They walk beside you right now. That you are part of a long lineage of those who have journeyed to awakening and journeyed into the vastness of being, and that your practice continues endlessly, awakened or unawakened, moments of enlightened activity or not. So let's continue to practice again for another year. Thank you.